before we reconsider this bill, I'm not going to let it come back until we get resolution. So tell us quickly what you want and what you've agreed to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I'm Jim Marquis, representing Amalgamated Transit Union, and I apologize for not being here earlier. These amendments didn't get typed in time. We've had a lot of problems on buses, as you know.
I'll be back.
Local Government Personnel Institute, representing cities and counties. We've worked with the proponents of the bill to come up with a compromise on the bill. In front of you on LGPI letterhead is that compromise. There is only one portion of that two-page compromise that we have not agreed on, and that's Section 8 of the second page. It has to do with whether or not a locker is...
Ma'am, if I was you, I'd take it out, because if it doesn't come out, this bill isn't coming back up.
We'll take it out if we can have the rest of it.
No, just take it out. You see, This bill has already passed. See, so you know, I mean, I hate to be so brutal, but this bill has passed.
What you're saying is none of the other compromise changes that we've agreed to with.
I'm saying 8 is out, but everything else is in.
All right.
You don't understand? I'm just saying that you hadn't agreed, you hadn't compromised on Section 8.
That's true.
Okay. Well, then 8, the locker thing is still in.
Okay. The rest of the compromise is agreeable to the committee.
Are you, Mr. Kaiser, you all right with the rest of the compromise on the LP?
Yes.
LGPI letterhead? Okay. Now, Mr. Marquis, yes. You have an amendment for us on the attacking of...
Yes.
Attacking of police, of transit officers? Attacking the bus drivers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Jim Marquis for Amalgamated Transit Union. The effect of my amendment is simply to...
Sorry. Talk philosophy. Wait, Ms. Bloom, do you want to...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jackie Bloom from the City of Portland, and with me is Tom Williams from the City Attorney's Office. I know in the interest of brevity, I will just let him get to the issue here.
I assume you're part of the LGPI amendments.
No, we have an addition of our own.
Oh. We have a separate amendment, Mr. Chair, which would correct a decision of the Oregon Supreme Court that came down June 13th that has to do with a exemption from public disclosure under the public records law. It would make more sense out of this exemption, and we understand that all the parties are in agreement as far as this amendment is concerned.
Okay, Mr. Kaiser?
We agree.
That's the one right here, so City of Portland. Okay, now, Mr. Marquis, quickly.
Jim Marquis, Amalgamated Transit Union. The effect of my amendment simply makes it a Class C felony to assault or cause physical injury to a person while they're operating or in control of a public transit vehicle. Presently a misdemeanor, and we've had a lot of problems in Portland, as you know, with gang violence on the bus.
Okay. The chair would, let's start with the chair would move the LGP. Well, chair, first of all, move reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 703 passed. Any objection?
Yes.
You object? Okay. I do not have enough votes here. I've got 5. Actually, I'm
Courtney's here in the middle.
What?
Yeah, Courtney's up front. Bill.
Hmm? I know, but I still don't have enough. It takes 5 to reconsider. And he's number 5. So, okay, Representative Brian?
Would you go look? Courtney's just finishing up a bill.
Okay, why don't you sit down, Representative Brian? We need you. Assuming arguendo. Some of us are learning not to talk to
each other. Voting again.
Vote? Okay.
seconds ahead. So you have to move the vote.
Yeah, the voting machine is using 30 seconds to push the button, and then it locks them out. I was not trying to get excluded guys. And I would much rather have this thing agreed upon.
Back into work session now. We were discussing Senate Bill 103 the chair would move reconsideration of the vote by which Senate Bill 103 passed. 703. Any objection to the reconsideration? Okay. Now, we have before us three sets of amendments, as far as I can tell. One set of amendment is the LGPI set of amendments, and these amendments themselves have had one deletion. Section 8 has been taken out on the acquiescence of Mrs. Haas. The second set of amendments are those proposed by the Amalgamated Transit Union, which basically makes the attacking of a bus driver a Class C felony. And the third set of amendments, which I'd like to discuss very briefly, are being presented by the City of Portland. These amendments are to overrule the case of City of Portland versus Rice and Rutledge, a Supreme Court case that essentially allows or compels disclosure of investigations of law enforcement personnel in those situations result in imposition of disciplinary sanction. Now,
what's the policy reason for overruling that Supreme Court?
Well, that's an awfully good question. Now, I've Mr. Kaiser's in here, and he tells me the police officers are in love with them. Mr. Marquis is neutral on them, on the city amendments, and I think Ms. Bloom and the city attorney will very briefly discuss them. To be very frank, the chair is not particularly in love with them, but that's because my wife, until 2 days ago, was chairperson of the Police Internal Audit Investigation Committee. I've had some experience in this area, but that's another story. Why don't you tell us in 20 words or less why we should be courageous enough to overrule the Oregon Supreme Court?
I think that PIAC committee that you mentioned presents one reason. The status now is if a request is made for a Police Internal Investigation Division file, while the investigation is going on, we don't have any definition of whether that file is exempt or not. In other words, the matter has to go to its conclusion, and it's only if a sanction is imposed that the file will be exempt from disclosure. In other words, it's a result-oriented type of thing. If there is a punishment imposed, it is exempt from disclosure. If there is not, then it is not exempt from disclosure, and it presents some temptation for the supervising person to impose a sanction in order to make the record not subject to disclosure.
Ms. Bloom, comment on the amendment?
I prefer to give all the time to Mr. Williams, since he argued the case in the Supreme Court.
Ms. Remington, you have a comment there from...
We vigorously oppose this amendment. I participated back in the very first session when the public records law was enacted, and I think this was a deliberative decision. The idea was to protect people who were disciplined from exposure, but the intent was, in my view, that there should be availability, that it is in the public interest to keep a window open to be sure that there are not whitewashes going on in internal investigations. And I can tell you from long experience of calls that we have in our office that there is a widespread suspicion, and I'm not saying the suspicion is warranted, that little attention is getting and that police officers protect one another. I think in this case, I want you to understand that this Rice and Rutledge were a couple who were reported a burglary and had officers come out to their house, and they believed that they were really engaging in much misconduct and followed it up with a complaint. When they were told that there was no finding of no need for a sanction, that they hadn't engaged in misconduct, they wanted to see those records to see what kind of an investigation. And I think it's definitely in the public interest that we keep that available. This case has been won all the way up, and now there is an attempt to just get around the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah. Well, Representative Mannix, I want to move this on, and if I can count, I think.
Oh, I don't know how you count me yet.
Go ahead.
My concern is this. I can see both sides of this. When I read the advance sheet, rather the press release, not even the advance sheet on the decision, my immediate reaction was it was kind of ironic that when the disciplinary proceeding closes down with no charges brought, that those records have to be made, the exemption does not apply, and yet if charges are brought, that the exemption does apply. It seemed the exact opposite of what I would want to see happen. It seems to me that this is not the time or place for us to be focusing on this limited circumstance, and I'd like to hear some argument as to how and why we should rush to judgment on this. For instance, I could see an alternative position being that anyone who presented the complaint that led to the disciplinary proceeding should be given a limited right of access to confirm that justice has been done. But we're not in a situation in terms of time where we can deal with that. Yeah. We're into black and white situations here.
Well, let me kind of just for a moment here, Representative Calori, how do you feel about this so far? Do you know? And Representative Courtney, how do you feel about this particular amendment so far?
So neutral, I'm not really excited.
Okay, Representative Bryan, you like the amendment, don't you?
I like the first one better.
Okay. Representative Baum, where are you on this?
Fine.
And Representative Bauman?
No, it's not.
Okay, so does anybody want to make a little more argument before?
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative.
And I think coming from a position of being both a legislator and a police officer, and having been subjected to numerous internal affairs investigations by the
not that
police
numerous,
girl,
so just
numerous.
Okay.
One, I'll tell you.
Just trying to help.
I got a complaint 9 years ago. Somebody said that they saw Officer Menace twirling his gun in the halls of the courtroom or the courthouse in Multnomah County, like Wild Bill Hickok, which
I
never
saw
occurred.
That too.
And
I'm you do that?
Right. But the point is this.
Well, you
and I bring that one up because it's in it. But the point is this. The point is that Internal Affairs investigated that complaint very much in depth, to the point where what happens is you get brought into a little room, they record everything, they give you all of the different rights and so on and so forth that you have afforded to you by your union contract. And they told me, they said, John, even if you did what this person says you did, it is not a violation of any of our rules. However, we have to investigate it anyway. They take anonymous complaints and continue. And I think the problem that I see, the argument that I have against the ACLU is this, that an officer, by the nature of the work that they deal with, the area they work and the shift, are subjected to continual complaint. And a good example is when I work with DUII detail, night shift, East Precinct. You're dealing with people who are intoxicated, and by the nature of the work that you're involved in, you get a series of complaints that are higher than. Once they're investigated, under this ruling, you're exonerated. Your entire record can be revealed to the press and the public only for the purpose of, well, not for, only for the purpose, but to the extent that it could destroy an officer's reputation publicly, because police officers are public officials subject to the scrutiny of the media. And I would suggest that for that reason, and that reason alone, is the strongest reason to allow this exemption record, because you have police officers who are constantly being complaining. If you ever want to get at a police officer, you ever want to burn a police officer, you just get a group of citizens to begin to start complaining against them and subject them to internal process and watch them go down in a flame of fire. Even now.
Well, Representative Minnis and everybody else, all due respect, I mean, I'm in fact, you're probably pushing me the other way, but unless somebody has something compelling to say, I really would like to get on with this bill. This is an add-on to the original bill, which
has
passed once, so it's back here again. Representative Mannix, do you have anything further?
I'll make a motion on an amendment, and I'd like to see it read this way.
Okay.
What we're doing here is we are giving exemptions from the public records law. I would go with the City of Portland to this extent. A personnel disciplinary proceeding, excuse excuse me, page three of their submission, which is page two of their amendment language, where they're showing changes in section 13. I'd have it read, a personnel disciplinary proceeding or materials or documents relating to any such proceeding, except that the complainant who presented any charges leading to such proceeding shall have a right to review the records relating to that proceeding.
Starting with Representative Minnis, reaction.
Well, I think in lieu of nothing, that over nothing, I think it's a good option, at least it does provide that initial reaction. The question I would have is whether or not the individual's attorney would have the same access in the event that there's some litigation.
I think I'd state for the record that an attorney should be able to stand in the place of his client to review the records. I'm looking to a balance between the right of privacy of any individual who works for the government. Government officials have a right of privacy, too, in regard to disciplinary charges, as opposed to the public's right to know. In this case, the public's right to know focuses on the complainant's right to know that the disciplinary proceedings were carried out fully and appropriately, that is, that the investigation was carried out, there was a proper review. If you allow the complainant a window of access to the proceeding, you've got that protection. At the same time, you're not letting every member of the press, frankly, look into a disciplinary proceeding where the charges were found to be not warranted, and it's a personnel matter, and that's what we're talking about, personnel matters, not other kinds of proceedings.
Reaction from the City of Portland.
I'd be concerned about the fact that we get a lot of requests for this information in criminal proceedings. The defendants in criminal cases go sign a complaint at IID, and then they have their attorney come and ask for it. And I don't think it's clear whether or not that use could be made of it in this manner.
Reaction from Representative Minnis.
If someone brings charges and the charges lead to a disciplinary proceeding, the person who brings charges would have a right to review the record relating to that proceeding. That's part of the balance.
Mr. Kaiser, in response to the proposed amendment on Representative Minnis.
That sounds okay. I just have one question.
Yes.
You're talking about a criminal proceeding. Would that mean that they could use that information in the criminal proceeding?
It says, I was careful here. I said shall have a right to review the records. I didn't say have a right to copy or right to keep. Right to review means look at.
Pretty logical.
Wait a minute. Who's going to have the right?
The person who brought charges that led to a personnel disciplinary proceeding would have a right after the proceeding is over and no action was taken. To take a look, or if action was taken for that matter, to take a look at the documents, the record, the transcript, whatever has been put together. Now, if they have some separate civil rights against in this regard, there's always a subpoena power of the courts. If you've got some potential civil action against an officer, you can separately subpoena those records.
I'm sorry, where are we? Representative Courtney?
The right of an individual to go into public records and make it so restrictive. I mean, if it's done, that's one thing. But I don't know how you have to do that.
Well, first of all, they're not public records unless we say they're public records, and what we're saying is they're private records.
Except
that the person who brought the complaint has a, you may not have been here earlier, Representative Courtney, when the discussion was, how does a person know that a proper investigation was carried out, that the matter was properly reviewed? This gives the complainant an opportunity to ascertain that the matter was properly handled.
And if it wasn't, they can use what they saw in the record to bring further charges?
I would just say that at that point they have a basis for complaining to the police officials about inappropriate action. That's about all.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we need to move because this committee. I hate this to use the dynamite charge. This committee is on its way to adjournment. This is the last hearing on these particular bills. I don't even think civil is going to meet anymore. Family justice is going to meet one more time. The only things left on our table, menu, pardon the mixed metaphor, is sentencing guidelines. So with that, Representative Courtney, do you have a motion? Does anybody have a motion on the
I have a motion on
okay. Yeah. Representative Minnis moves the City of Portland amendments as amended by his interlineation. No, that's fine. Now, why don't we just for the sake, I'll call a roll on Representative Minnis. Representative Minnis.
Aye.
Representative Clory. No. Representative Bauman.
No.
Representative Bauman.
Yes.
Representative Bryan.
Aye.
No. Now, let's move on. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Mannix.
I move the city department amendments without any change.
Without any change?
So it reads a personnel disciplinary proceeding or materials or documents relating to any such proceeding, period, or semicolon, as they presented.
Doesn't that make them even stronger?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Clerk will call the roll on the further Mannix amendments.
Representative Baum?
Yes.
Baumann?
No.
Bryan?
Aye.
Glory?
No.
Courtney?
No.
Mannix?
Aye.
No.
Sure.
Representative Bryan.
Move the amendments depicted in LGPI handout minus section 8.
LGPI handout minus section 8. Any objection? We'll try it that way. Okay. Adopted.
Chairman.
Representative Bryan.
Move the amendments depicted on the amalgamated transit union 219.
ATU amendments. I believe there will need to be a vote on this. Any further discussion of this? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Baum?
Yes.
Mr.
Bellman?
Which one are we voting on?
This is Bellman. Making attacking a bus driver a felony.
Bryan?
Aye.
Glory?
Aye.
Courtney?
Yes.
Mannix?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye. Okay. The chair would move Senate Bill 703 to the full committee. Do pass as amended. Any further discussion? If not, clerk will call the roll. Yes, Representative Mannix.
Did anyone discuss, while I was absent earlier, what happens if someone is recklessly driving a car and crashes into a bus and injures the driver?
No, not yet, but if you'd like to.
Committed assault in the third degree? Better drive carefully. Okay, thank
better
you.
Drive carefully. Okay. Clerk, call the roll on the bill itself.
Representative Baum.
Yes.
No.
I'm sorry, I did not hear Representative Baumann's bill. Representative Baum was talking. Oh, okay.
Aye.
Bryan?
Aye.
Glory?
No.
Courtney?
Yes.
Mannix?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye. Okay, for the purpose of the record, the chair would move that we adopt our prior action on 591 and 131. Any objection to adoption of our prior action?
Wait a minute.
No.
I said, wait a minute.
Yes.
591. What do you do? What do you mean?
No, we're fine.
We're fine.
Counties have authority to set jail plan limits.
And they have. Credit card was what is let out the back door. That's all we could
have. Yeah, but folks, there was a little stumper. It went off.
Representative Courtney, this. The adoption of our prior action was in reference to a dialogue which occurred on the floor about the actions of a rump committee meeting without authorization.
The word medium was inserted in the bill, but this was a false
action. Don't listen to him. Okay.
We did not stuff anything in.
We did not stuff anything in. Okay. Now, let's get to 1073. Finally, Ms. Bogan, Judge Ellis, please. I apologize for how long this has taken. We're going to meet on this until 5:30 or so, and then we're going to come back tomorrow morning. So I don't know where we were. I'm kind of going to defer to the good representative from Milwaukee.
Southern representative from West Lynn.
West Lynn on this.
Southern general.
What's your pleasure on 1073, Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do is, there is a bill called 1073, which has a whole lot to do with a whole lot of things other than my amendments. And I'd like to hear from the certified smart people what it does.
Okay. Ms. Bogan. Let's not have any people leaving on this one. Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Bogan.
I'm Kathleen Bogan. I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Council. With me is Judge James Ellis from Multnomah County, who's an associate member of council, has worked on the guidelines for over a year now, and Bob Durston, who's the project manager. I think what we'll do is go through the bill and summarize the sections for you, not reading them and not going into a great deal of detail. And
Representative
do we
Clark.
Have, do we have the bill yet?
We do not have the bill from the Senate yet. It was heard Friday.
Did they change it from the B engrossed?
What?
It's the B engrossed. It's the B engrossed.
B engrossed.
1073B.
It's engrossed.
It's printed. It's printed B engrossed.
The speaker is not shown, is not a not deigned to send us the bill yet. Some of us she won't.
Want to send somebody down to the bill room?
Here, just bring up copies of 773.
Okay. Do you also have?
I have a few amendments.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mannix.
Can I suggest that since we've heard a lot about sentencing guidelines, that what we could hear is what changes the Senate made from the, and maybe some people want to hear it just presented section by section. I'd rather just hear what changes were made by the Senate as opposed to what we've heard before.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
In response to that, Representative Max, it's my understanding that Senate Bill 1073 is nothing like anything we've ever seen before, because it has, we sort of heard vague references to it. I realize we don't have time for a section by section, line by line summary, but I do think that, Bogan, you gave me a 25 or 30 minute briefing last week on this bill. Maybe a condensed version of that would be helpful.
Okay.
Because it is helpful. It's helpful to me.
Ms. Bogan.
I'll try to repeat that. This bill has new language in it relating to things like appellate review standards and plea negotiations. It has some brand new law in it. Most of it, however, is changing existing law, sometimes in very technical ways, making the Board of Parole and post-prison supervision, so that when you look at the 91 sections, or however many there are, all 91 of those are not new major substantive changes. There is a section-by-section summary which I think has been distributed to you. Counsel, is that correct?
Okay.
Which explains what each section does. The major areas that I highlighted in my outline for Representative Clark are the appellate review. There's a standard for sentence review that will be new in Oregon law in this bill, providing for substantive sentence appeals. It allows for the first time that the state can appeal a sentence, which is not now permissible under law. It phases out temporary leave. It's another major change. It reduces it to 90 days as of November 1, 1989. And eliminates it completely as of November 1, 1990. For people sentenced under the guidelines, there is no temporary leave program at all. There is, provided by the Senate, a change in the effective date. You've heard us talk about September 1st, 1989. All of us were getting very concerned about the time that's available to train judges and district attorneys and defense attorneys and parole and probation officers in how to do the guidelines calculation and sentencing. So the date was changed to November 1st, 1989 to give us an extra 2 months to get that accomplished. The Senate also put into the bill, which we had brought in, some language relating to misdemeanors. That is at section 51. We are not the first state
Page 24.
We're not the first state to do guidelines, and therefore we have the advantage of observing other states to see where certain problems arose that we might maybe anticipate. One of the problems is that when you provide for sentencing guidelines for felonies, if you have a system structured so that people could be sentenced as misdemeanants and therefore given a longer jail term, then the felony guidelines might provide for a prison term, that you can anticipate that there may be some manipulation of charging practices or sentencing practices. And that has a significant impact on two things. it has a significant impact on the criminal histories of those people who are sentenced as misdemeanants instead of as felons, so that you get an increasing inaccuracy in those records. It also has an impact on local jails, and the counties are concerned about that, and the sheriffs are concerned about that. What the Senate did was to put into law a temporary cap on misdemeanor sentences so that no misdemeanor could be sentenced to a jail term of longer than 6 months.
A jail term, excuse me.
Existing law says misdemeanors can be sentenced up to a year. We have a considerable database on felony sentencing practices. We don't have a database on misdemeanor sentencing practices, but the judge is here, and I think current wisdom is that very few misdemeanants are ever getting anywhere near a year in local jails now. This cap has exclusions for DUII. They could be sentenced up to a year if the county has jail space available. And there's an exception for sex offenses or attempted Class C felony sex offenses, so that those offenses could also be sentenced to jail.
Let me stop you. That sounds...
a week for a misdemeanor, so whether we can sentence them to 6 months or a year is a matter of indifference. As I understand it, there are several other counties that they simply do not sentence misdemeanors to jail at all. There are no jail sentences. There are counties, I'm told, where five-time drunk drivers get no days in jail because they have no space for misdemeanors. So I think it will depend a lot upon what county the judge is in. But I would think there'd be a lack of enthusiasm about it.
I'd like to point out, Judge, that even though that some counties like Missouri, you can get 10 days in jail, your vehicle seat or shooting elk out of seat, let alone a Class C felony treated as a misdemeanor. But yet, has this changed? Has it been run by the circuit judges, district judges, or
A vast body of material in connection with guidelines has been sent out to judges. Whether this particular provision was or not, I'm not certain. I know some judges are aware of it.
When was this put in? It's always in here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baum, that specific language was the result of a conference meeting. The DAs, the defense bar, court administrator, Judge Ellis, you were there.
Yes.
There was no district court judge there.
When was that
meeting? Before the Senate voted the bill out, so it was a couple of weeks ago. So this specific language, the district court judges probably have not seen.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Mann.
Back to this substantial and compelling language on page 11 of the B. and Gross bill. I noticed that in line 23, we talk about review shall be limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact justifying a departure from the sentence prescribed by the rule are supported by the evidence and constitutional substantial and compelling reasons. We don't refer to reasons, we refer only to findings of fact. And I wonder how you feel about us inserting the words and reasons. So say on 23, line 23, page 11, be limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact and reasons justifying a departure. Technical point, but you're only talking about findings of fact. Findings of fact themselves do not constitute substantial and compelling reasons for departure. There's got to be some logic presented, some reasoning process presented in regard to those findings.
Does line 26 solve that problem?
No, because the operative language is limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact, and then you pick up, are supported by the evidence, constitute substantial and compelling reasons. Findings of fact may, in the minds of some, constitute that, in the minds of others, not constitute that. And I think we want to require the judge to give reasons, not just findings of fact, which is a different thing. Reasons are similar to the conclusions, and then you get to ultimate findings and ultimate conclusions.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That the language
logic
should say the court must state, besides the findings of fact, the reasons.
Mm-hmm. Just say be limited to whether the sentencing court's findings of fact and reasons justifying a departure from the sentence. Two words. someday some lawyer is going to play games with that otherwise, and I just assume stick those two words in now if you're agreeable to that. I'm not proposing it right now, I'm just trying to get a reaction.
Why don't you note that?
That sounds like a good idea. The rules have some language similar to that.
Later, but you talk about factual findings. Excuse me, go ahead.
What's next, Representative?
I'm prepared to go inside for some more questions.
Certainly, go ahead.
Talking about the stipulations, stipulating to appropriate grid blocks. Is there anything there we need to talk about? I noticed that it's possible to stipulate to an appropriate grid block without agreeing for the actual sentence to be imposed. How does that work? If you stipulate to the grid block, aren't you in fact stipulating to the sentence to be imposed?
You've still got departure. And there's a range within each block. So you've got first the range, and then the possibility of departure up or down outside the range. The ranges are fairly narrow, months, but that's fairly significant. And I think the thought there was we don't want to introduce a necessity to prove things that people agree to. And if the state and the defendant agree that the crime is of this severity, and reading the columns across that the defendant's prior record is thus and such, we don't want to put the courts and the state to the expense of judicially establishing.
You still have your trial on whether the crime was committed.
Yeah.
Then you go to the sentencing phase, right. And everybody came and stipulates to this and this, and you argue departure standards, or you argue within the range, or some such thing.
Although we expect that the typical case will be without the trial, because around the state we're disposing of 85% to 95% of the cases without trial now, and the experience, at least a judge came down from Spokane, testified before the Senate committee that their experience in Spokane had been that they had less trials under guidelines than they had before, because of the lack, because of the certainty. The defense lawyer can say, and if you plead guilty, here's the presumptive sentence. You don't say, and the possibility is 20 years. And their pre-sentence investigation report was greatly reduced as a result of that.
There were some issues that came up about proof of criminal history and how to do that. And I guess I don't understand why there could be confusion in that area. You either have a series of convictions or you don't. But it's generated a lot of controversy. Maybe you could.
As a practical matter, it's not that easy to find. Usually, if you have a circuit court conviction in the same county, the district attorney can locate that with no difficulty. If you have a district court conviction, you may or may not be able to locate it. That in Multnomah County, even locating misdemeanor convictions for traffic crimes are difficult. Finding traffic files, you have to remember what a traffic citation looks like. There's no file folders, and they handle 100,000 plus a year. And if one is misfiled, and once the OGIN system incorporates those, as I think it's going to, I'm not the person to respond to that, then you'll have a data processing system that can locate it. But locating a conviction for out of a justice court in another part of the state is a little more difficult for the prosecutor. And then when you go to out-of-state convictions, that can become very complex, and determining whether that out-of-state conviction, for instance, in California, they list a code number. They don't say burglary 1 or theft 2. They say the RC, I think it is, and a number.
Which raises another issue to me. How do you decide if burglary 1 in Alabama is a functional equivalent of burglary 1 in Oregon?
Prosecutor's burden. Just establishing any other legal issue. If you can't establish it, then it's not.
Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to ask you a question about page 13. Are we just kind of coming up with questions as we go along? Is that all right?
I've got about a series of six or seven areas that I wanted to kind of wander through and see what other questions are raised for the committee.
Right. So on. Page 13, you talk about the new state field of converted State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Say that five times fast. start calling them the Board of PPS. May advance the release date of a prisoner, lines 32 and 33, suffering from a terminal illness who was sentenced in accordance with the rules of the State Sentencing Guidelines Board. I have a general drift as to why you would want to do that, but I appreciate some explanation of your rationale for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, this, I actually think I should let Bob explain this. This was at the request of the parole board, because when we finished drafting the rules and the statutory package, we had completely ruled out this possibility from happening. And as I understand it, there are sometimes now releases of people who have extremely severe medical conditions.
I think I could give you some examples of that, because we've had some experience of that with our local jail, and I have a standing practice whenever I'm notified that somebody has even, not necessarily terminal, but an enormously expensive illness. I usually release them, because otherwise the sheriff has to keep them under guard in a hospital, and it's horrendously expensive.
Yeah. Representative Mannix, that's, I know a little bit about that. That's a position that probation won't mess with.
I just wanted to, I was assuming that we were talking cost control, and apparently that's what we're talking about.
And kind of purposeless. If someone is suffering a terminal illness, it seems kind of silly to keep a guard on the hospital door, hospital room door.
Depends on how incapacitated the person is, too, but I assume that they will consider that fact.
The ones I'm thinking of are usually, well, another category, I've released quite a number of women to give birth, because it's far cheaper. No, that wouldn't fit this, but it's an example of the kind of thing that goes into this.
Where would that be covered?
The one I gave? I don't think it would. I think that's taken care of here in Marion County, and they are kept in custody.
Mr. Durston?
I think that in the jail situation, the judge always retains the right to furlough.
And I do.
But in prison, I think they have to stay in prison.
Well, there's still temporary release for 30 days. That'll still.
Well, the transitional leave for 30 days would cover that.
If they're within 30 days of release.
But you've
got somebody who's got 14 months more to go, and they're going to live about a month more, and it's going to be in a hospital.
Amen.
Well, I'd like to inquire further on that. I had understood that the temporary or emergency leave provision would still be in effect. It allows up to 30 days emergency leave.
I think that's the concept. I'm certain, I'm not sure of the language, was temporary leave, which is a population control device, is
but
eliminated.
Wasn't, no, there was two. There's one that's up to 30 days. It was always there.
Yeah,
then
that's
it was increased
transitional.
To 180 days.
That's the transitional leave. For instance, the parole plan for a number of prisoners is entry into a residential drug treatment program. And the desire is always to have them released and that day go into residential drug treatment. That's somewhat dependent on the available bed, because the drug treatment program is ordinarily full. And in order to make sure there are no intervening days, that this provision would give the, I don't know whether it's the parole board or the Department of Corrections, I think it's Department of Corrections, the authority to release up to a certain number of days early to match the entry of that drug program.
If I can follow up on that, though, as I understood it, we were still going to say that, say someone's got 5 years to go on a sentence, and that person's mother dies in South Dakota, that if that the provisions may be made for that inmate should be released to attend the mother's funeral, whatever, under emergency leave. Is that all being washed out of the system? They just stay in.
There's no provision for, there was no provision for any emergency release or leave of any sort, which is why the parole board asked for this language.
Okay.
And you've just identified several other situations that aren't also not covered.
Yeah,
in
that,
the existing
let's package. Highlight that.
Pregnancy is not, unless someone is within 30 days of their release date.
I think through the pregnancy issue, and unless we have co-ed prisons, there should be a 9-month window there, right?
Well, you wish.
Unless visitation is friendlier than I thought, or we have co-ed prisons, there should be a 9-month window there, after which it's not a problem.
There are still guards.
Well, I guess I want to pursue this for now and find out what really happens. You have women in the facilities who have been there for 3 years who are getting pregnant?
We have one who's gotten a lot of publicity in recent years.
But she had to escape.
No.
No?
No, not according to the book. I won't go into it, and it's bizarre, but it wasn't attributed to the staff.
I'll wait to see the movie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think one problem would be if someone were perhaps in the initial stages of pregnancy when introduced into the institution.
That's what I'm saying. There's a 9-month window there.
Yes.
Well, you have people coming out and having parole revoked and brought back.
Which raises another a whole different issue for me. My understanding is you said temporary leave is being eliminated as of November of 1973. What about the whole area of good time, earned credit? What all is happening with earned credit? How much people being given for what? How does it affect the census actually served?
There are currently two good time programs that can apply to offenders in the prison. One of them is the program that gives them a third off of their sentence. The sentence, the 5-year, 10-year, 20-year sentence. Our understanding is nobody ever gets within 2/3 of the complete sentence. So that 1/3 off situation never operates. There is, however, the parole board's reset authority, which allows them to grant people increasingly shorter parole release dates, which is another kind of good time policy. Now, the guidelines in 1073 propose a different program, which is only, it's to be governed by rules of the department, but it is only to be applicable for program participation. It's not just for sitting in your bunk. And you can earn up to 20% off of the presumptive sentence, a maximum of 20%. Minnesota and Washington have programs that allow you to earn up to 1/3. The board felt very strongly that that was far too generous, and 20% was as high as they were willing to go.
Can you explain what you mean by program participation?
Let me let Bob.
Yes. Representative Calori, the committee initially crafted a system that would tie it very specifically to actual program participation with some very complicated administration
like
where the offense.
Like school or
work,
school,
Mr. work programs? Let me stop you right here. You've gone across one of my lines. I've always felt very, very strongly that for control of inmates, you need some way to control inmates. And you've lost that control if you don't do this on behave yourself to get your good time. I feel very strongly about that. Explain to me why you've taken that away.
Chairman Mason, I don't believe we have taken it away. What I was trying to get to was the fact that at first we did have a very, very narrow concept of what this earned credit would be. After talking to representatives from the Department of Corrections, we did recognize exactly what you stated, that they need to have some management control. And if we take away the earned program for the under the parole resets, they're basically without aid. What we did instead was to tie it to proper behavior in the institutions. And we did ask that would be tied somehow to as much participation as the facility does provide in terms of programs. So an offender will not be put at a disadvantage if there are no programs to participate in.
The language is on page 27, it's line 36, and it just says appropriate institutional behavior. The original idea was to make it half behavior and half programs, but it was pointed out that at least at present, many inmates do not have an opportunity to participate in programs. So, but that everyone involved in this agreed with your view that you simply probably could not manage the institutions if there's no incentive to not throw your mess tray on the floor during every meal and that kind of thing. It also seems to me that, as I was saying here, 20%, notwithstanding I'm the committee, 20% seems a little low. That's 1 in 5 days. That was actually, Michael Franke was the one who came up with the number. What was the logic to 20%? Very early. He thought What we were shooting for was as low as possible and still achieve the result.
Yeah. Tradition would have you 1 and 3, wouldn't it?
That, at least here.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I say it sounds so traditional, but that's just what good time always is.
Look where tradition has gotten. 20 sounds high to me. It really does.
Well, it's actually not. I mean, it's,
I'm sure it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking 20% of reduced real-time sentences compared to one-third off phantom sentences.
Well, no, that was before. Yeah. It was one-third off...
time set back to the
prison. Yeah.
Pardon? Which is the one...
Actual time set by the goal.
Yeah, it was one-third. So this is a substantial reduction in that. It's like,
well,
a 13% reduction.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that good time or earned credit has always been aimed at the theoretical... rational, reasonable inmate who sits there and makes a calculation about how he or she is going to live his or her life in the institution and says, I can get out of here sooner rather than later if I just toe the line. It seems to me that 20% is going to do that for a reasonable, rational inmate just as likely as 33% is. Or
20% is, I guess,
you know, we passed a bill this time that said that everybody would be either involved in an education program, a rehabilitation program, or a work program. So
didn't pay for it.
Well,
as a study.
I guess I wonder
nobody
how that
loves those programs, but nobody loves to pay for them.
We do.
Too bad we're not.
How would that work?
Yeah.
My guess,
we're saying, and on one hand, everybody's going to do this, and then we're saying, on the other hand, only those who do it get rewarded. I have a little, see how that quite meshes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Corey, this program is going to be governed by rules of the department. And so my suggestion to you would be that if the day ever came when there were funding so that everybody in the prison were involved in a program or something, the department's rules would probably therefore change and say it isn't enough just to be involved in a program. You have to also be well-behaved and that it would go beyond that, I think.
One of the suggestions made by one of the corrections people at the time we were working on this is that it's probably not enough just to have people involved.
Yeah.
You want them to successfully complete.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that involvement should not be the test. But until we reach a situation where most of the inmates have the opportunity to do that, probably can't make that criteria. We were going to have 10% for behavior, 10% for program.
Yeah.
And that was eliminated when it was pointed out that there appeared to be no likelihood that in the immediate future programs would be available.
Representative Mannix, that was yours. You got another one, or should we go back to Representative Clark?
I'm done, thank you.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, two other sort of what I see as major issues in the bill itself. I think I might want to leave one for the morning because it strikes me as being maybe it'll take a while. And that's the one about the board being allowed the authority for interim adjustment of the guidelines and capacity projections aren't met. So, you know, that was going to generate some discussion. But one-fourth of the judiciary committee, you know, for that. But the other one.
And also, Representative Clark, I'm a little... put out, to be very frank, that other members of this committee have not shown to show up. I mean, given
this happened every time this subject has been.
Well, and given all the smoke and fire, and concern and rhetoric on sentencing guidelines, it astounds me that the other members are not here.
And it's always the same people too, by the way.
Yeah,
that are here and aren't here.
Go on,
Representative. Just to say that three of the members who've been creating the smoke and fire are here. the one that I would like to talk about this afternoon, though, is it's this interesting little political bombshell in there that says from now on out, instead of the chairman of the Sentencing Guidelines Board being appointed by statute and being the Attorney General, that the governor is going to appoint the chairman of the Sentencing Guidelines Board.
Where is this? What page?
I don't even know where it is.
It's section.
Trying to figure out which campaign manager wrote this provision
or if there's a policy behind it.
Who won and who lost?
Yeah, who won and who lost? That's the only
thing I can figure out.
Well, I understand. Either
the governor wins or the I understand it's been resolved. It's section 38 of the bill. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, my understanding is that the Attorney General will continue to chair the board. The governor, of course, would be free to appoint the Attorney General under this language, for one thing. It's section 38. It says that the language, the amended language, would say that the chair was no longer the Attorney General, but that the governor would appoint a person to be the chair. The governor would be free to appoint the Attorney General. My understanding is that the Attorney General will continue to chair the board if there's some point in the future at which everyone amiably agrees that they want to do something else, then the governor has the authority to appoint someone else, which without the statutory change, the governor would not.
All the joking about campaign managers in 1992 or 1990 elections aside, I understand that there is a legitimate policy professional concern that the Attorney General has in terms of conflict of interest. Maybe you can help us explain that.
Wrong person to ask. Representative Clark, I'd like to say this is the first time I've come upon this fight. It's about the 10th. And getting between the governor and the attorney general is dubious at best.
I understand, but I have to raise the question right now, Mr. Chair, because you're outvoted as of right now.
Yeah.
You really do anything.
I know.
You have to do it right now.
Yeah, right. Without your quorum.
Like a bunny.
If I might be somewhat facetious, there are two chief law enforcement officers in the state of Oregon, believe it or not. Right?
One of whom is the attorney general. And the other of whom is the governor. And in fact, beyond Ways and Means, was it 6 months ago? We had this little tiff over criminal justice grants.
Uh-huh.
And this one's easy. You can pick your choice. It's pure turf. You know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. But they can give you a rational answer, but I'll call it.
The attorney general's concerned about conflict. It's the stated purpose.
This language was inserted at the request of the Attorney General. My understanding is that he has some concerns about conflict of interest potential, and that the two people involved have had discussions about how this might work, and that this language is agreeable to. My understanding is that this will work to both of their. It's acceptable to both of them.
I won't raise the issue. It's not an issue.
Only if we want to talk about future attorney generals.
Well, we may have a couple here in the room.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. He'll find out about it.
Go on, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, other than the question of interim adjustments by the board and the numerous amendments that Representative Clark and I worked up, that's all I have. And I guess we do. We also have another committee meeting at 5:15.
Okay.
I would like to suggest that we adjourn until tomorrow morning at 8 and try and get maybe each of us could try and get some of the folks.
You're not going to break our heart. I think that's a good suggestion.
I have a conference committee.
Why don't we come back at 8 tomorrow morning? Judge Ellis, I hope we're not taking away from anything really compelling.
Some people will be awfully disappointed not to see me tomorrow.
Well, I bet they will. Raymond, time is it?
So perhaps they may come and testify.
Can I check on the amendments we really are proposing? We've got 18, 19...
18 through 26.
18 through
26.
Those are the ones.
Yeah, and I inappropriately labeled them Clark. They are Clark Lori Burton amendments.
And then will the witnesses be prepared to give us a reaction?
And I think I have reviewed two or three others that are not as
comfortable. I don't have any amendments to this bill.
Anything, I'll say go to the order.
I need another.
Any objections to adjourning?
I'll grab one of the amendments.
sets of grappling at the end of the set.
Process.